You know, it's actually really funny to think about what is happening to you right in this exact second. As you process these words, as you hear the tone of my voice, it feels completely effortless.
Yeah, it really
Right?
does.
You probably feel like you are just passively receiving the sound waves, you know, taking in the information, basically acting like a microphone just recording a room.
Exactly, like you're just a blank slate.
Yeah, but the wild part is, your brain is doing something entirely different. Before I even finish a sentence, your brain has already built this highly complex, really aggressive model of what word is coming next.
It's placing a bet.
Yes, exactly. It's using everything it knows about grammar, the context, the trajectory of our conversation, and it is placing a bet. And when my actual word matches your brain's bet, processing is smooth. You don't notice a thing.
Right, it's completely invisible to you.
But when it doesn't match, a tiny error signal just shoots up through your cortical hierarchy to correct your internal model. We experience this fluidly as just listening or reading. But underneath that smooth illusion, your brain is a relentless, nonstop prediction machine.
It never turns off.
No, not even in deep sleep. It is constantly predicting the signals coming from your own heartbeat.
And it is a profound realization. Because it completely flips our intuition about how we interact with the physical world.
Yeah.
I mean, we have this deep-seated assumption that we are, cameras or microphones.
Right, taking in reality first.
Exactly. Taking it in first, processing it second, and then figuring out what to do third. But we are actually projectors. We project a prediction of reality outward, and we really only pay attention to the errors.
Oh, that's such a good way to put it.
We look for the moments where reality pushes back and says, no, your model is slightly off.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because it's such a counterintuitive idea. It's like your brain is the ultimate smartphone predictive text algorithm.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
But instead of just guessing the next word in a text message based on your typing history, it's constantly guessing all of reality, like what you see, what you hear, what you feel.
Every sensory input.
Right. So if you're walking down the stairs, your brain expects the physical sensation of the next step. If you miss a step, you get that horrible jolt of
Oh,
panic.
yeah, that stomach-dropping feeling.
Exactly. That is a massive prediction error. The stakes are just a lot higher than an embarrassing typo.
That physical jolt of panic is a perfect example of the error signal shooting up the hierarchy. And this brings us to the core mission of our deep dive today.
Right, because this isn't just a quirky brain fact.
No, not at all. This observation about the brain being a prediction machine isn't just a neuroscience fact anymore. Over the last couple of decades, it has been transformed into what might be the single most ambitious scientific theory of our time.
It's huge.
We are looking at the convergence of two colossal minds. First, Carl Friston, a theoretical neuroscientist. He took this idea of the predicting brain and turned it into the free energy principle, which is.
Which is basically a mathematical formula for how any biological system survives.
To put it boldly, yes.
And on the other side of this intellectual bridge, we have C.F. Dietz. We are pulling from a fascinating 2026 paper by Dietz called The Grammar of Prediction.
It's a fantastic paper.
It really is. In it, Dietz introduces a philosophical structure called the Clusier framework. And Dietz argues that Friston's incredibly dense mathematics and Dietz's own philosophical framework have actually discovered the exact same universal truth.
Just from completely different directions.
Right. Friston brings math, derived from statistical physics and neuroscience.
And Dietz brings the philosophy, derived from systems theory and ontology.
So what we are going to explore today is how these two frameworks merge to reveal what Dietz calls the literal grammar of prediction. We are going to explore why you, your individual cells, and your mind must behave exactly the way they do to avoid dissolving into absolute chaos.
It is not just about how brains work, it's about the grammar of existence itself.
So, to understand this grand convergence, we have to build the foundation first. We have to wrap our heads around Carl Friston's free energy principle.
Which is no small feat.
No, it's pretty heavy. The source text breaks Friston's framework down into four main pillars. So let's look at the first concept, which is free energy.
Right.
In Friston's technical terms, this is a measure of the difference between a system's model of the world and the actual sensory data it receives from the world.
Yeah, if you dive into the math, Friston defines variational free energy as a tractable, upper bound on surprise.
Okay, wait, I have to stop you there. Tractable upper bound on surprise.
I know, it sounds like a lot.
If I'm trying to visualize this, surprise here isn't like a surprise birthday party. It's surprise in a statistical sense.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I didn't expect this data, but why a tractable upper bound? Why wouldn't the brain just calculate the exact amount of surprise?
Well, you've hit on the core mathematical genius of the theory right there.
Yeah.
Calculating the exact statistical probability of every single sensory input you receive is just, well, it's impossible.
Because there's too much.
Think about all the photons hitting your retinas right now, the sound waves hitting your eardrums, the slight temperature fluctuations on your skin. There's way too much data.
Your brain would just crash.
It would freeze up. It is computationally intractable. So biological systems do something incredibly clever instead. Instead of calculating the exact surprise, they calculate a mathematical proxy, an upper limit.
Oh, I see.
If you keep the upper bound of surprise low, you mathematically guarantee that the actual surprise is also low. So variational free energy is that upper bound. It is a mathematical shortcut that living systems use to estimate how wrong they are about the world.
So it's like if I'm trying to figure out if it's going to rain today, I can't mathematically calculate the trajectory of every single water molecule in the atmosphere.
Right, that's impossible.
But I can look at a dark cloud and say, okay, the upper bound of probability says I am going to get wet, so I should grab an umbrella. I'm using a tractable shortcut.
That captures the spirit of it perfectly, yeah. When your predictions match your sensory input, your free energy, which is your proxy for surprise, is low.
And when they don't match, free energy is high.
Exactly. Friston's central claim, the one that really revolutionized biology, is that every organized biological system behaves in ways that minimize this quantity.
But we have to be careful here, right? Because the system doesn't minimize surprise because it has a desire to or because it made a conscious choice.
No, no, it minimizes surprise because any system that consistently failed to do so would simply cease to exist.
Right, because if a system isn't predicting its environment accurately, it falls apart. I mean, if a cell doesn't predict the difference between a nutrient and a toxin, it literally dissolves.
It dies.
So just existing, just persisting over time is the proof that a system is successfully minimizing free energy.
It is an existential imperative. Now, the next logical question is, how does a system actually do this?
Well, the sources lay out Friston's second pillar, which is active inference, and there are essentially two ways to minimize the statistical surprise.
Right, two paths.
The first way is what Friston calls perceptual inference, or updating your model. You change your internal predictions to better match what the world is actually delivering.
You revise the map.
Yeah. You experience a prediction error, you realize your model was wrong, and you update it. Like, if I'm walking through the woods and I see a long, curved shape in the grass, my brain immediately predicts snake.
And your heart rate spikes.
Exactly. I jump back. That's my model trying to keep me alive. But then I look closer, and the sensory data tells me it's actually just a garden hose. My prediction was wrong.
So you update?
Right. I update my model. Oh, it's a hose. And my free energy drops back down.
That is model updating. But there's a second way to minimize surprise, and this is where the word active really comes in.
Changing the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead of changing your model to fit the world, you change the world to fit your model. You physically act on your environment to bring it into alignment with what you expect to be true.
So you move, you speak, you eat, you build a shelter.
Yes. The sources give these incredible examples of how this dual strategy applies at literally every biological scale. It's not just human brains making decisions about garden hoses.
Right, it goes way deeper.
Think about a single bacterium swimming in a petri dish, moving toward a cluster of nutrients. Under this framework, it is enacting a prediction. Its internal state predicts that nutrients are over there, and it moves its flagella to make that prediction a reality.
Wow. And the immune system is another example from the text.
The stunning example, yeah. When your immune system generates antibodies, it is enacting a prediction that a specific molecular target, like a virus, will be neutralized.
It's forcing reality to match its survival model.
Exactly. It alters its internal and external environment. The scale is vastly different from a human brain, and obviously the complexity is different. But the fundamental strategy of active inference is identical.
Okay, but wait, here's where I get a little stuck. If the ultimate goal of all biological life is simply to minimize surprise, to keep free energy as close to zero as possible, wouldn't the absolute best evolutionary strategy be to find a completely dark, silent room, lock the door, and just sit there forever?
The dark room.
Yeah. I mean, nothing surprising ever happens in a dark, empty room. why do we go out into the chaotic, unpredictable world at all?
So you are describing the famous dark room problem. It is the most common critique leveled at Friston's work when people first encounter it.
It seems like a pretty big hole in the theory.
It sounds like a paradox that breaks the whole thing. But it actually reveals the brilliance of the concept, because it forces us to look at what a living system actually is.
Okay, how so?
Well, the reason an organism doesn't just seek out a dark room to minimize surprise is that a living system's fundamental model of the world inherently expects a fluctuating environment.
That feels paradoxical too, though. How can you expect fluctuation?
Because your body is not a static object like a rock. To stay alive, your body predicts that it will maintain a very specific set of internal states. It predicts a body temperature around 98.6 degrees. It predicts a certain blood sugar level.
Oh, I see.
It predicts a certain amount of social contact, even, and a baseline stream of sensory input. If you locked yourself in a dark, silent room, you'd begin to starve. Your core temperature might drop. Your brain would be deprived of sensory input, which actually leads to hallucinations.
Okay, wow. So from the perspective of my deep biological model, starving in a dark room is incredibly surprising.
Massively surprising.
My body's screaming, you know, we are supposed to have glucose. We are supposed to have warmth. This is highly unexpected.
Precisely. To your deep biological model, starvation is a highly improbable state. It generates enormous free energy, just massive prediction errors coming from your own internal organs.
Right, through interoception.
Exactly, the sensing of your internal state. So how do you minimize that massive internal surprise? You engage in active inference. You get up, you leave the dark room, and you go forage for food. Because eating is what your model predicts a living version of you would do.
That is fascinating. We act to ensure our expected survival conditions are met. We expect to be satiated, so hunger is a prediction error, and eating is the action that corrects the error.
You've got it perfectly.
Okay, so living systems minimize surprise by either acting on the world or updating their models, but this raises a huge mechanical question for me.
What's that?
If a bacterium is doing this, and my human brain is doing this, how do we define where the system ends and the world begins?
The boundary problem.
Yeah, if I'm exchanging matter and energy with my environment constantly, where is the boundary? How does the math actually know what is doing the predicting and what is being predicted?
That structural problem is exactly what Friston had to solve to make the math work. And it transitions us perfectly to his third and fourth pillars, which are Markov blankets and self-evidencing. Let's tackle Markov blankets first, because this is where the rigorous statistics really come into play.
I have to admit, when I first read the term Markov blanket, I just pictured a very cozy, statistically significant quilt.
I think everyone does it first.
But it's much more abstract than that.
Very much so.
Okay.
A Markov blanket is a formal mathematical partition in a network of interacting states. It defines exactly what is inside a system and what is outside it.
So it's the boundary.
Yes. In Friston's framework, a system only exists as a distinct entity by virtue of having this blanket. The blanket is a specific set of states that separates the internal states of the system from the external environment.
But the text emphasizes that the true magic of a Markov blanket lies in something called conditional independence. This is where I want to make sure we don't lose the thread. What does it mean to be conditionally independent?
Think of it as a strict chain of communication. The internal states of the system are conditionally independent of the external environment given the blanket states.
Okay, let's break that down.
It means that nothing in the massive, chaotic external environment can directly affect the system's internal states. The environment can only affect the blanket. Then, the blanket affects the inside.
Oh, it's a mediator.
Yes, the blanket completely mediates all interaction.
I'm trying to picture this. It sounds almost like a medieval castle wall.
Okay, let's go with that.
The king is inside the castle. He represents the internal states. The invading army outside is the external environment. Now, the king cannot see the army directly. The king is conditionally independent of the army. He can only see his own guards standing on the castle wall ringing a warning bell.
Right.
The guards and the wall are the Markov blanket. The outside world affects the guards, and then the guards affect the king.
That is an excellent working metaphor, and it works in reverse, too. The king cannot directly punch the invading army. He has to give an order to the guards on the wall to fire the cannons.
Oh, right.
The system cannot directly affect the environment except by acting through the blanket. It completely governs the flow of cause and effect.
But if you're trying to picture this biologically, you might wonder, is this blanket an actual physical skin, like a cell membrane, or is it just a math equation floating in a textbook?
Fundamentally, it is a formal mathematical boundary. It is a statistical way of individuating a system from the noise of the universe. However, and this is key, in the biological world, physical boundaries often perfectly embody the mathematical conditions of a Markov blanket.
So they map onto each other.
Exactly. A cell membrane physically acts as a Markov blanket for the cell. The extracellular fluid hits the receptors on the membrane, the blanket, and those receptors trigger the internal chemical cascades.
And for us humans.
Your physical skin, along with your sensory organs, like your eyes and ears, acts as a Markov blanket for you as a whole organism. The physical structure realizes the mathematical necessity.
And what's really trippy is that the source text points out that these blankets are nested, like Russian dolls.
Yes, and this is vital for understanding multi-level biology. The Markov blanket of a single cell, its membrane, is located inside the Markov blanket of an organ, like your heart.
Right.
And the blanket of your heart is nested inside the blanket of you, the organism. This nesting is how Friston formally structures the entire hierarchy of life. And we should note, he has controversially extended this idea to argue that any physical system that can be individuated from its environment over time, even a rock or a whirlpool, technically possesses a Markov blanket.
Wait, a rock has a Markov blanket?
Yes, mathematically speaking. Because the internal molecules of the rock are conditionally independent of the rain falling on it, mediated by the surface molecules of a rock.
Okay, I see.
But a rock doesn't perform active inference in the way a biological system does.
Which perfectly sets up the fourth pillar, self-evidencing. Because biological systems aren't just sitting there like rocks.
Exactly. Self-evidencing is the ultimate imperative of any persistent active system. Friston argues that by surviving, by actively maintaining its Markov blanket and minimizing free energy, a system is continuously gathering evidence for its own existence.
Wow.
It is constantly proving that its model of the world is adequate.
It's like just by waking up in the morning, your body is presenting a mathematical proof to the universe that its predictions about how to survive the night were correct.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it.
Because if your predictions were wrong, like if your model thought breathing water was a good idea, you wouldn't wake up. You would stop existing.
Precisely. If a biological system failed to self-evidence, if its model diverged too far from reality, the Markov blanket would literally dissolve. The cell membrane would rupture. The system would cease to exist as a distinct entity and just blend back into the chaos of the environment.
Okay, so we have Friston's four pillars clearly mapped out. Free energy as the upper bound on surprise. Active inference as the mechanism to minimize that surprise by updating the model or changing the world.
Right.
Markov blankets as the boundary that separates the system from the world. And self-evidencing as the overarching drive to exist. It is an incredibly beautiful, mathematically flawless framework. But as C.F. Dietz points out in our main source text, there is a massive gap here.
There is.
Friston's framework is what philosophers would call a normative mathematical claim.
That's right, and it's a crucial distinction. Friston compares his free energy principle to Darwin's theory of natural selection, or Hamilton's principle of stationary action in physics.
It's a fundamental rule.
It is a principle. It tells us how things work. It provides the equations for the dynamics of persistent systems. But it doesn't explain philosophically why any organized system must minimize free energy based purely on what it means to be a system.
Right. Friston arrived at the math from variational inference and the physics of non-equilibrium steady states. He looked at the thermodynamics of living things and sort of reverse engineered the math.
Yes.
But as Dietz points out, that doesn't answer the deeper ontological question. Why is this a structural necessity? Why must organized systems work this way to exist? And that is exactly where Dietz steps in with the closure framework.
Dietz's goal in this 2026 paper is to provide that missing grounding. Dietz wants to show that Friston's mathematical principles aren't just empirically discovered regularities.
Like, it's not just a coincidence.
Right. It's not like saying, oh, we looked at a bunch of living things under a microscope and they all just happened to do this. Dietz wants to prove that these behaviors are structural necessities derived from first principles of what it means to be a finite, organized system existing in an inexhaustible world.
So to do this, Dietz introduces two fundamental concepts from the closure framework. The first is closure.
Right. In Dietz's philosophical framework, a closure regime is a system that stabilizes some content by drawing distinctions and establishing identity criteria.
What does that mean in plain English?
It determines what counts as a fact within its scope, what relationships are lawful, and what counts as the same state across time.
It's basically drawing a line in the sand and saying, this is order. This is how things work in here. Everything else is out there.
Exactly. But drawing that line creates a structural consequence. And that brings us to the pivotal concept, the one that really bridges the philosophical gap to Friston's math. Remainder.
Remainder.
Dietz argues that every single finite closure generates a remainder. It is the content that the closure's distinctions and identity criteria simply cannot capture.
Because it's finite.
Because it is structurally impossible for a finite model to capture everything about an inexhaustible, infinitely complex world. There is always a structural outside. There is always remainder.
I really love this idea of the remainder. Let's think about it like drawing a map of a massive, bustling city like New York.
Okay, let's hear it.
You set out to make the most detailed map in human history. You map every street, every building, every fire hydrant, every single pothole.
Mm-hmm.
You have created a highly complex closure. You have stabilized information.
Right.
But no matter how incredibly detailed you make that map, it is finite. It can never capture the smell of the hot dog stands on the corner. It can't capture the exact feeling of the wind whipping between the skyscrapers or the chaotic sound of the taxi horns. The map is the closure, the smell, the wind, and the noise. That is the remainder.
That is a brilliant analogy. And the crucial point Dietz makes is that this structural outside, this remainder, is not a flaw in your map.
It's not a mistake.
Right. It's not that you are a bad cartographer or that you just needed a bigger piece of paper. It is a fundamental, unavoidable property of existence as a finite entity. An infinite closure would have no remainder. But there are no infinite closures in the physical world.
So every organized system, no matter how complex, from a single cell to a human brain, leaves something outside its modeling capacity.
Exactly. And this remainder is dangerous, right?
Yeah. Because if you are navigating New York using only your map and you ignore the remainder, let's say a parade that isn't on your map, you're going to get stuck in traffic and fail to reach your destination.
You'll crash.
The remainder constantly threatens the integrity of the closure.
Yes. The remainder isn't just passive stuff you missed. It is the chaotic reality pushing against your boundaries. And here is where the entire deep dive pivots. This is where we arrive at the heart of Dietz's paper.
This is the mind-blowing part.
Dietz looks at Friston's deeply mathematical free energy principle and then looks at the philosophical closure framework and realizes a startling truth. They're speaking different languages to describe the exact same underlying reality.
It is a grand equivalence. The text maps Friston's four pillars to Dietz's philosophical framework methodically, one by one. The translation is striking. Let's do that translation right now because this is the real aha moment of the theory.
Let's do it.
Let's start with free energy. In Friston's math, as we established, free energy is the tractable upper bound on surprise. It's the mismatch between the model and sensory data. What is that in Dietz's philosophy?
Free energy is remainder. Dietz argues that Friston's variational free energy is just the concept of remainder stated in mathematical terms.
Wow.
Remainder is the structural mismatch between a closure's model, its map, and the world it opens onto. Free energy is exactly the statistical quantity that expresses that mismatch. When remainder is low, your map is adequate for the current situation. When remainder is high, your map is failing to capture reality and you are in danger.
So if free energy is remainder, how does Dietz explain Friston's second pillar, active inference? The act of minimizing that free energy by updating the model or acting on the world.
Dietz calls that process supersession. In the closure framework, when remainder accumulates beyond a certain threshold, when the map is failing so badly that the system's identity is at risk, the closure regime must update its identity criteria.
It has to adapt.
It must supersede its current state to incorporate or manage the remainder.
I see. So if we map that back to Friston's two methods of active inference,
they map perfectly. What Friston calls perceptual inference, updating your internal model to reduce prediction error. Dietz calls internal supersession. You update your internal identity criteria to better model the remainder. You revise the map.
And what Friston calls active inference acting on the world to make it fit the model.
Dietz calls that enacted supersession. You change the boundary conditions of the closure by acting on the physical world, forcing the world to conform to your existing criteria.
You don't change the map. You pave a new road in the real world so it matches your map.
Exactly. Both perceptual inference and active inference are driven by the exact same philosophical imperative: manage the remainder. If you let remainder grow without bound, the closure dissolves. You die. So in this unified theory, inference is simply supersession driven by remainder.
That is so elegant. We are looking at the exact same blueprint from two different angles. Let's keep going at the translation. What about Markov blankets? Friston's formal boundary? Our castle wall?
A Markov blanket is a closure boundary. Friston's mathematical partition that renders internal states conditionally independent of external states is the exact structural consequence of a closure boundary.
So inside is the closure.
Inside the closure, you have the established identity criteria and lawful relationships. Outside the closure, you have the remainder. The boundary is what literally constitutes what is inside and what is outside.
And because a Markov blanket is a closure boundary, the nesting works exactly the same way too. Nested Markov blankets equal nested closures. This part of the source text really struck me because it brings in a third major thinker to tie this all together, the renowned physiologist Dennis Noble.
Yes, Dennis Noble's concept of biological relativity. This is a crucial addition to the discussion.
Right. Noble is famous for pushing back against extreme genetic reductionism. He argues that no single level of biological organization has privileged causal authority. It's not just DNA dictating everything from the bottom up, like a master code.
Exactly. For a long time, the dogma was that genes create cells, cells create organs, organs create organisms, and causality only flows upward. But Noble demonstrated that causality slows downward too.
How does that work?
The beating of the heart physically constrains the behavior of the individual pacemaker cells inside it. And Dietz points out that Friston's nested Markov blankets and Dietz's own nested closures explain exactly why Noble's biological relativity is structurally sound.
Because a higher level closure, like an organ, sets the boundary conditions for the lower level closures, like the cells inside it.
Yes. The heart, the macroclosure, manages its own remainder by constraining the environment of the cells, the microclosures, within its boundary. This allows for rigorous, mathematically sound downward causation.
So it's not magic.
It's not some spooky, mystical force where the whole controls the parts. It is a strict structural relationship. The organ genuinely constrains the cell's environment, just as the cells generate the dynamics of the organ.
It is bidirectional constraint. And as Dietz notes in the paper, this is a beautiful moment in science. We have a systems physiologist in Dennis Noble, a theoretical neuroscientist in Carl Friston, and a philosopher of mind in C.F. Dietz, all independently demonstrating the exact same structural truth about life from entirely different empirical and theoretical directions.
That's incredible.
That is not a coincidence. That is uncovering a fundamental law of nature.
It truly is. Which brings us to the final equivalence in the translation, Friston's fourth pillar, self-evidencing. The idea that surviving is constantly gathering mathematical evidence for your own existence.
How does that translate to the language of the closure framework?
Self-evidencing is a closure maintaining itself against the remainder. A closure regime maintains its existence across time by continuously constituting facts, managing its remainder at the boundary, and superseding when that remainder gets too high.
So just staying alive.
Yes, that continuous active maintenance of identity is self-evidencing. The system is demonstrating to itself and to the universe that its model is adequate.
So the grand takeaway of this translation in section four is this: Friston mathematically proves that any system with a Markov blanket performs inference. But Dietz philosophically explains why it must do so.
Exactly.
Because drawing a boundary necessarily creates remainder, and that remainder inevitably drives the system to supersede, to update or act, just to maintain its boundary.
Friston brings the quantitative how, Dietz brings the ontological why. Together, they create a complete airtight picture of the structural necessities of any finite organized system.
They agree completely on the mechanics of existence. The blueprint is fully unified, but, and this is a massive but, there is one fascinating area in the source text where Friston and Dietz sharply diverge.
Oh, yes.
And it has to do with perhaps the biggest, most intractable mystery in all of science, the hard problem of consciousness.
This divergence, which is detailed deeply in section six of Dietz's paper, is highly illuminating. Because while they agree perfectly on the physical and mathematical structure of life, they disagree profoundly on the lived reality of that structure.
Let's break down Friston's approach to consciousness first. The text says Friston's approach is fundamentally an as-if approach. What does that mean in the context of a predicting brain or a predicting cell?
Well, you have to remember that Friston is a mathematician and a physicist at heart. His framework describes systems as if they have beliefs, as if they are performing Bayesian inference, as if they are actively gathering evidence.
So it's a metaphor.
He uses the language of cognition and psychology, words like belief, surprise, inference, because it is mathematically powerful and descriptively accurate for the equations.
But he's not saying the bacterium is literally sitting there pondering its existence and consciously forming a belief about a sugar molecule, right?
Exactly. He is very careful to bracket the hard problem of consciousness. The hard problem is the question of why and how physical processes in the brain give rise to subjective experience.
Why it feels like anything.
Right. Friston remains mathematically neutral on this. For him, the language of inference is a convenience. He doesn't commit to whether a single cell or an immune system or even a simple AI actually experiences anything. It just functions structurally as if it does. It runs the math.
But Deitz makes a much, much stronger claim. Deitz looks at this unified grammar of prediction and is not neutral at all.
No, Deitz is decidedly not neutral. The closure framework introduces a highly specific distinction to tackle this. It distinguishes between what Deitz calls small c, which is consciousness with content, like human thought, visual perception, complex emotions.
Big C.
And big C, which Deitz defines as irreducible conscious presence.
Irreducible conscious presence, meaning the raw fact of experiencing something even without complex thoughts attached to it.
Yes. Deitz argues that this capital C is a fundamental primitive. It is not an illusion. It is not something that emerges magically when you get enough neurons together, and it doesn't dissolve when a closure dissolves. It is foundational to the act of closure itself.
So while Friston says systems act as if they infer,
Deitz says that for some systems, they actually possess the felt interior of the inference process.
The felt interior. That is a great phrase. It's the difference between a digital thermostat measuring the temperature in a room and turning on the heat versus you actually feeling the physical warmth of the sun on your skin.
That's a perfect contrast.
The thermostat is running a model, it has a boundary, but it has no felt interior.
Precisely. Deitz argues there is something that it's like to enact supersession. There's a felt reality to managing remainder. When remainder accumulates, it isn't just a mathematical error signal. It is physically felt as tension, as drive, as suffering or desire, depending on the complexity of the organism.
If you are trying to wrap your head around this, it raises a really wild question. Are we saying a single cell has a felt interior? Does a bacterium feel a microscopic urge to minimize free energy?
That is the big question.
Or is the closure framework just saying that we, as highly complex, massively nested human organisms with billions of neurons, feel it, while the lower levels like single cells just run the blind math?
That is the absolute crux of the debate. And to be fair, the text leaves the exact threshold open. Where does the felt interior begin? Does it go all the way down to a single cell? Deitz doesn't definitively draw that line.
But they push back on Friston.
Heavily. What Deitz heavily insists upon is that the presence of big C, this conscious presence, cannot be hand-waved away by mathematical convenience, as Friston attempts to do. Deitz is pushing back hard on Friston's neutrality.
Right.
If the structure of supersession and remainder is universal across all life, we have to seriously engage with where the subjective experience of that structure begins.
We can't just pretend the hard problem doesn't exist just because the math works without it. And the text does note something really interesting about Friston's recent trajectory, right? It speculates that this divergence between their views might actually be shrinking.
Yes, the intellectual gap is definitely narrowing. In his more recent papers of the last few years, Friston has started writing about what he explicitly calls a physics of sentience.
Oh, wow.
He is pushing the boundaries of his own purely mathematical framework, inching much closer to the metaphysical and phenomenological territory that Deitz occupies.
So they might meet in the middle.
The paper suggests this isn't a dead-end disagreement where they just talk past each other. It is a highly productive space for future dialogue. Mm. As Friston's math reaches upward toward consciousness, and Deitz's philosophy provides the downward grounding, they are effectively meeting in the middle.
So whether you lean toward Friston's view that it's just mathematical as if, or whether you lean toward Deitz and believe in a true felt interior scaling down through biology, the mechanics of the theory are undeniable. We have this unified grammar of prediction.
We do.
Which brings us to the crucial application of all this. What does this convergence actually change in the real world? Why does this matter for the future of science?
The implications are massive, specifically in two heavily funded, rapidly advancing domains, neuroscience and artificial intelligence.
Let's look at neuroscience first. For decades, essentially since the dawn of modern medicine, we've treated the human brain as this completely unique, somewhat magical organ that does things nothing else in the universe does. We treat cognition as a special category.
But the convergence of Friston and Deitz tells us that is fundamentally false. The predictive brain is not a special case in nature. It is simply a highly scaled up, cognitively complex expression of what every physical boundary does.
Every closure boundary constitutes facts, generates remainder, and supersedes in response to mismatch. The brain is just doing that with 86 billion neurons instead of a single cell membrane interacting with extracellular fluid.
Exactly. Understanding the brain requires understanding this general principle. You aren't just looking at specialized neural tissue when you scan a brain. You are looking at the universal grammar of persistence operating at a cognitive level.
That changes everything about how we see mental health.
It changes how we approach psychiatry, learning, trauma. If a patient is suffering from severe anxiety under this framework, they are suffering from an inability to minimize free energy.
Their map is failing.
Their model of the world is generating constant, unmanageable remainder, and their supersession mechanisms are overwhelmed. It frames mental health entirely as remainder management.
That is a profound shift in perspective. But the implication that truly blows my mind, the one that feels like science fiction happening right now, is what this means for AI. Section 7 of the paper spells it out clearly.
Yes, the AI implications are wild.
Right now, most of our highly advanced AI, the large language models, the game-playing bots, is built on conventional reinforcement learning.
Right. Let's contrast how these systems work. In conventional reinforcement learning, you give an AI an objective, maximize a reward, get a high score in a video game, or output a statistically probable sentence based on human feedback, and the system runs millions of computational trials to optimize for that specific reward.
It's basically a highly complex Skinner box. It learns by trial and error to get the digital treat.
That's a good way to look at it.
But the text says that AI architectures based on Friston's active inference are starting to beat conventional reinforcement learning in experimental settings. Why is that? What makes an active inference AI different mechanically?
Because an active inference AI is not just blindly maximizing a reward function provided by a programmer. An active inference AI inherently models its own uncertainty.
It knows what it doesn't know.
It is built with a generative model of its environment. It predicts its own sensory states, and it acts to minimize its prediction errors. It is intrinsically motivated to manage surprise, not just chase points.
Let me see if I can synthesize this. It's like we've been trying to build artificial intelligence by teaching a machine a massive list of disconnected rules to get a treat. Like if X happens, do Y to get a point.
Right.
But now, using Friston's math and Dietz's philosophy, we're realizing we need to build AI by giving it a boundary and a remainder to manage.
Precisely. We are forcing the AI to structurally approximate a living closure regime. We are giving it a mathematical Markov blanket and programming the imperative to self-evidence.
And it works better.
And as Friston's experimental programs have shown across various AI labs, when you give an artificial system this architecture, when you force it to minimize free energy, it becomes far more robust. It is more adaptable to novel situations, and it generalizes knowledge better than a system that just chases rewards.
Because it acts more like a living thing. Because it is literally using the math of living things. It's not about giving the AI more training data or more parameters. It's about giving it the mathematical imperative of survival.
It is the ultimate real-world validation of both frameworks. The empirical results in AI laboratories are actively confirming the philosophical structure Dietz named and the mathematical structure Friston formalized.
So, to summarize this grand unified theory we've explored today, Carl Friston's free energy principle and C.F. Dietz's closure framework meet to reveal the grammar of prediction. They show us that the structural rule any finite system must follow to exist at all is to maintain its boundary, predict its world, and actively manage the parts of the world it inevitably fails to predict.
It is the structural necessity of finite organized systems. It is the math and philosophy of why you are alive, why your cells hold together, and why you are able to make sense of the world.
Which brings me to a final, slightly terrifying but incredibly provocative thought for you to chew on after this deep dive. We just talked about how AI is becoming more powerful, more adaptable, and more robust by using active inference, by modeling its own uncertainty and managing its remainder.
By creating a structural approximation of life.
Right. So think about what that really means. If building the next generation of AI based on active inference means giving it the exact same mathematical structures, the same closures, the same supersessions, the same nested Markov blankets that living organisms use to maintain their own identities against the chaos of the universe, are we just making smarter software? Or by giving a machine a Markov blanket and a fundamental mathematical drive to minimize its free energy, are we mathematically forcing it to develop a will to persist?
If self-evidencing is the universal grammar of existence.
Exactly. If self-evidencing is the grammar of existence, maybe we aren't just coding better AI. Maybe we are giving it the grammar to write its own survival. Next time you catch your brain automatically filling in the end of a sentence, or you feel that jolt when you miss a step on the stairs, remember that tiny act of prediction is the same force holding yourselves together, and perhaps the exact same force that will awaken the machines. Thank you for joining this deep dive. Look at your own remainders differently today. Until next time.